And now, I see squared with Jimmy Cavanaugh.
Back on IC Squared. Thanks for coming back, folks. I'm Jimmy Cavanaugh, joined this week by Tim Donahue of the outstanding Pacers blog, 8 Points, 9 Seconds, over on the True Hoop Network, over on ESPN.com. Tim, thanks for venturing, I wouldn't say into enemy territory, but it's always great to have somebody on from the Pacers' point of view. And I love the stuff that you guys do over there at 8.9 Seconds. You're one of my favorite writers to read on that site.
Well, appreciate it. And thanks for having me. I love Tom Lewis and Cornrows. It's very good. So
I'll be real, because the second that I got that I started doing this podcast, one of the first questions I asked Tom was, there's not going to be a problem with bringing the 8.9 Seconds guys on, because I could see their a potential for conflict maybe somewhere there, and thankfully that's not the case. It seems like blogs tend to get along pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, we're all kind of doing the same thing, and you know, Tom, and like I said, Tom was one of the guys I got to meet when I first started getting credentials to the Pacers games, and he was really good to me. And it's all, you know, we all like basketball, we all like a lot of us like the Pacers, and I think we're just trying to do the same thing, so there's no reason for us to be competitive, especially with the smart guys that write on both sites. You know, obviously not me, but yeah, it's just, there's just too much good writing to kind of worry about any kind of rivalries like that. So
you're too modest, Tim. Well, we'll take it at that and go right into some of the stuff that I want to talk about. Last time that you and I talked, it was a while ago, I think a year and a half on podcast form. But one of the things that stuck with me was how enamored you were with David West and the impact that he had on the Pacers team that stretched the Heat in the Eastern Conference semifinals 2 years ago. Just how central he was to the team. We both saw the way he played in that series and that postseason in general, having the potential to carry over into the regular season. It did this year. He was outstanding all year long and was a central player in the Pacers getting as far as they did. Just talk about what you saw from David West this year. You're one of his biggest fans.
Yeah, definitely a big fan of David West, and both as a player and as a guy that is really an intelligent guy to speak to. He's somebody that is a little bit of a basketball wonk, in that, you know, you can get him talking about the way the play is supposed to work, and if you ask the right question, he'll kind of light up and really give you a nice insight into the way the players think. I there was a quote that Quinn Buckner mentioned on one of the broadcasts this year, where he said he had been talking to Kevin Pritchard, I think it was Kevin Pritchard, and Kevin Pritchard made the comment that David West was who the Pacers want to be, and I thought that was a perfect way to sum it up. If you think about who he is, he's physical, he's bright, he's no nonsense, he's a credit both on the floor and off the floor, he's skilled, he works hard, and he's really respected in the locker room, and I just think there's a lot of value in a guy like David West. And you know, Frank Vogel had a big impact on the culture and what he wanted to do, but I had spoken to Vogel in November or December of last year, asking him what it meant to have a guy like David West in the locker room, what it meant to the coach. And he pointed out that West was one of those rare guys who could, you know, get on everybody in the locker room and do it with respect and have it accepted. And I think we saw a lot with O'Brien and under O'Brien that there was a big problem between the coaching staff and the players, and it really helps when the coaching staff has a player like David West who can help be one of the coaches that, you know, can play the heavy or the vice principal from time to time. And then, of course, he's just so skilled. He's, you know, one of the best, you know, the 17-foot assassin and just a fun player to watch.
Totally agree on all counts. I actually wanted to get something that you said and blow it up a little bit, because the fact that David West is who the Pacers want to be is such an undervalued thing for people who don't watch the Pacers regularly. I remember reading Bill Simmons' Midnight Run NBA column on Grayland. I can't even remember how many weeks ago, and it stopped me in my tracks to read about him making an argument for Josh Smith over David West as a more valuable forward, as a better forward in basketball. Like, not just physical skills, not his ability to impact the game in a certain way. If he said it this way, I have the quote in front of me, the player behind the best forwards, LeBron, Durant, these guys, he ranked him sixth. Blake Griffin behind him. You take Josh Smith over Serge Ibaka, Anthony Davis, and everyone else except maybe David West. I don't think there's a maybe anywhere in there. David West is a clear value over Josh Smith. I don't understand why people have such trouble getting this.
Well, I do think, Josh Smith is a special talent, and he's a guy that I had at times thought might be the right kind of power forward to play next to Roy Hibbert, because, you know, he could block shots and he covers a lot of ground and that type of thing. I got to be honest with you, I can't be objective because I'm not a huge fan of J.R. Smith. A lot of it's because he spent his entire career playing against the Pacers, but also I think that he checks out from time to time, you can kind of see it in the way that he, he's such a skilled player. It's interesting. There was a debate that was going on in the internet about Josh Smith, and one of the things that came up was the fact that he shot 47% from the floor, and which is actually a very good percentage. Generally, the league shoots around 45%, so he shoots it very well, but it's kind of an intriguing thing. He shot something like 73% in the restricted area and was the third or fourth best in the restricted area this year. But out of 250 some odd players that played more than 20 minutes a game, only 19 shot worse from outside of the restricted area than Josh Smith did. The thing that I don't like about Josh Smith offensively is that, I think he lets the defense off the hook from time to time. You can kind of see him let things go. I'm not close enough to the situation to know what he's like in the locker room or anything like that, but I can't imagine anybody else being better than David West in the locker room. He really was important. David West and George Hill's another guy that are so crucial to the Pacers, because I'd written a piece during the Knicks series right before game 6 when it was unclear whether Hill was going to play or not. And the point that I made in that was that, Paul George, all of the Pacers are team players. All of them. That was a very fortunate group. They were all for one for all. When you look at Paul George and Roy Hibbert, they do the best for the team by doing what they do. They make sure that they do what they do as well as they can do it. And that's very important, because they're both very talented and team-oriented players. But David West and George Hill, they're the guys that make sure the team does what it does. They're the ones that kind of keep the Pacers on the beam. And I was a big believer in the fact that a lot of the reasons that the Pacers got through some rocky periods both early in the season, and a lot of people forget how badly they played in April. They had trailed like by 20 or more in their last 7 games in April. And I think they got through that simply because they knew who they were. And who they were comes from Vogel, and it comes from West, and it comes from George Hill. I think that's something that, in my mind, just watching up close, I wouldn't expect Josh Smith to be that kind of contributor.
That, to me, is the biggest thing, because the identity the Pacers have come from David West centrally. And if you're Josh Smith, as he was on a decent Atlanta team for the past several years, I think you can see all of his positives and all of his negatives at the same time. The Pacers got to see that in that series that they played in the first round. In the elimination game, I distinctly remember watching, the Pacers had a solid lead. I can't remember. I think it was more than 20 points. The Hawks coming back and had a chance for a nice shot to either take it to one possession or tie it. And Josh Smith pulls the biggest Josh Smith shot that anyone's ever seen in that kind of moment. I think it was a shot that he needed to hit to keep the Hawks in the game. He pulls up from three with a ton of time on the shot clock, and the announcers say it. I started laughing out loud to myself in the hotel room where I was staying, because there's no way that anyone else but Josh Smith would be expected to take that kind of shot with his skill set in that situation. And there's no way to overstate how much more valuable David West would have been in that situation. A, a lot more likely to hit the shot. B, a lot less likely to take it, because he'd make a better pass to one of his teammates. I think the fact that the Hawks were as bad as they were in certain periods of that series and in certain periods of this season has a lot to do with Josh Smith's personality inflicting itself on the team. Not for good, not for bad necessarily. He's just a different player. And I don't want to belabor the point anymore, but I don't think there's a question you take David West over him.
Well, I think that the Pacers are happy with David West, and I think for the situation, certainly. But, you know, there are a lot of people who would disagree with us. I think I think from a straight talent perspective, Josh Smith has more. He has the ability to do more, but I just don't know. I had written a piece about Tyler Hansbrough a few years ago, where I compared him to Al Harrington, and in it, one of the things that I think happens to some NBA players is that they become, they're very talented, but they end up becoming more important than they should be on a team. And I wonder if that doesn't happen with Josh Smith. In other words, he'd be a fantastic. Fantastic in like a Luol Deng type of situation, but I don't know that he'd ever really accept it.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think that makes any sense. And the people who say that Josh Smith is better than David West, I'm sorry, Tim, you and I are on the same corner. Those people are wrong. We are correct. We are right. We can move on. I want to get to the point where the Pacers managed to re-sign him. That was the big question, how much they were going to pay for David West. And a lot of folks think the Pacers overpaid. Now, as much time as we've spent on David West, we don't have to continue the love fest. I feel like the money they paid for him was a fair number, because he had been competing, essentially, I would argue, at a discount for the past couple of years based on the production he gave, especially during last season.
I think it was a fair deal. I understand the concern. What happens is whenever you've got somebody making $12.6 million when they're 35 or 36 years old, it's understandable to get nervous about it. But, you know, I really do think that organization was not even that's one of those deals that, you know, if David breaks down or if he has an injury, then it might look like a bad deal, but I don't think the Pacers will ever really regret signing it. He was a part of what they're trying to do in the short term and the long term. He played at depending on what metric you want to use. I mean, he had close to his best statistical year of his career last year, got all the way back to the same level. And like I said, he's such a big part of this, the identity of the Pacers and the fact that they're reclaiming an identity that had gotten so tarnished in over the last decade. And so I think it was worth it. And I don't think they're worried about it. You know, I'm sure they would have loved to have gotten him for less, but I don't think that that was something they were even going to sweat.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm not concerned about that because he's worth it to me. I agree. And he earned every penny of it with the way he performed in the last two postseasons and the last regular season. He's just been an elite-level player. He's one of the top power forwards in the East. And B, I look at his offense, and I wonder exactly where age is going to have a negative impact on him, because it seems like his game is designed to deal well with the aging process. I think David West is still going to be effective, knock on wood, as a 36-year-old power forward. Maybe not to the same level he currently is, but he's not somebody based off a ton of hops athleticism. He has great understanding of the game. I feel like he's going to age well.
Yeah, I think so too. Actually, Jared and I had this a similar conversation the day that it was announced that he was signed back in 2011 when they signed him to the two-year deal. And we thought, yeah, you're 90% sure that he's already got an old man's game, so you don't think it's going to go away. But also, sometimes you can't always tell if there are guys who are built on, you know, that little bit of window, you know, doing that little thing and hitting that jump shot, hitting that mid-range. You can never quite tell if you lose just a little bit, if that doesn't have a big effect on the game. I can remember watching Charles Oakley at the end, a different player, but one of the things that Charles Oakley always had that was just killer was a knockdown 17, 18 foot jump shot. And I can remember watching him towards the end of his career, and that shot just wouldn't go anymore. And you could just tell there was nothing left. Once that was gone, there was nothing there. So, but no, I think he'll be fine. You know, this past year, he did miss some time with the back, but I tell you, he had played 29 minutes a game in 2011 and 12, and then it jumped up to 33 minutes a game last year. And I know that Vogel didn't want to play that much. With Scola coming in, he can easily be rolled back to the 28, 29 minutes a game, because Scola is going to be a much more capable backup than Tyler was. And also, Scola is going to play very, very similarly to West offensively. I looked, and over the last 3 years, and I'm just doing these numbers off the top of my head, but over the last 3 years, Scola had shot just over 41% of it, taken just over 41% of his shots from the mid-range, and Hibbert or West had taken just under 41% of his shots, and the two of them, Scola had hit like 47.0%, and West had hit 47.1%, and that's just nuts. It's very
it's a little uncanny.
Yeah, it's they're both very smart. And the thing that when I got to go down to meet Scola at the media availability, and I got to talk to Coach Vogel about, you know, how similar he was. And one of the things that I noticed is that Vogel talked a lot about Scola's playmaking and passing ability. And it was very reminiscent of the way that Vogel talked about West when West came in. And I don't know if you recall this, but in that first year, a lot of outside observers who weren't watching, you know, his scoring was down, but he had actually been asked by Vogel to look to facilitate and pass more in that first year. So part of it was recovery from the knee, and part of it was just he was asked to do something differently. And I think a lot of that's going to be similar with Scola. So that's going to be a very nice thing that when you bring in a guy like Scola, that's going to allow you to take, you know, maybe 400 minutes off of David West's back this year.
Yeah, and that's something that, A, I'm laughing at myself because you stole my thunder in my next question. The transition from West to Scola is so much different than the transition from West to Hansbrough. I remember when Hansbrough was hitting that mid-range jumper, he was a completely different player, and it seems like the past 2 years with David West on the team, it's almost abandoned him. Luis Scola, a different character, but at the same time, I'm looking at this and wondering how Tyler Hansbrough struggled so much coming off the bench. Luis Scola has not really had that kind of experience coming off the bench. Is that something the Pacer fans should be concerned about?
Should they be? I think they're
concerned might be a strong word. Should they be aware of the fact that Luis Scola has not come off the bench very often at all in his NBA career?
Yes, I think that is going to be an important test because he's never played his rookie year. He played 24 minutes a game, and then last year he played around 26 or 27 minutes a game. So I'd written some of this when the trade was coming down. It's going to be interesting to watch it because clearly they're going to. I think he's a good soldier, and I think he's going to do what the team wants him to do. And I think as long as the team's winning, everything will be fine. But also I think they're going to need to make sure that they try to get him 24, 25, 26 minutes a game and opportunities because it'll keep him sharper, I think. It'll keep everybody sharper. And so it is different. He has never come off the bench before. And just my opinion was that it was something that you could tell was new to him. And I don't think he's going to be a problem, but he's a little bit nervous about it too.
I'm expecting there to be a transition period because I remember when the team finally had an option where David West is there. It took Danny Granger a bunch of time to acclimate. It took really the first half of the season for him to get used to his role. I'm guessing there are going to be some growing pains, which is something that might keep the Pacers from all the expectations that people have on them. But they're going to be just as dangerous, in my opinion, when the playoffs roll around, when these things have all gotten figured out.
Yeah, it was interesting. I certainly am thrilled that they got Scola. But it's in some ways it actually is a little bit riskier than before that happened when I thought that they were going to end up with playing some small ball with Granger and or Copeland playing the backup four. And the reason it's a little riskier is because you have to create more time for a guy like Scola. And he's going to have to adjust, and then with Paul George, and if Granger comes back healthy, and that's going to have an impact on two other players. It's going to have an impact on Lance Stephenson and Paul George. And, Paul George, I think, has, within the organization, evolved past, evolved past Danny. I mean, he's the guy. He's going to get a lot of money this year, and he's the guy. And one of the things that he talked about, really the only difference between playing a two and a three in Vogel's offense was that Paul George liked playing from the side of the floor that the three played from. And, last year at one point, Vogel said, well, either Danny or Paul are going to be playing the three 48 minutes a night. So there's going to be some adjustment there. I think there's going to be an adjustment with Scola and getting used to him coming off the bench. The guy that I think might not end up taking a step backwards next year is Lance Stephenson. I think he says all the right things, and I think he's ready to come off the bench. But he really, really, a lot of him blossoming, I think, was the fact that he was the fifth best player on the floor. He was the fifth starter, and he had a specific skill set that fit that. And I'm not sure how that works as he goes to the bench, and I'm also not sure how that works if he starts getting squeezed for minutes. If he goes, he averaged 28, 29 minutes a game last year, and if he's back getting 18 or 19 minutes a game, he's grown a lot, but he's still a young guy, and that's a hard situation for anybody to have to deal with.
Yeah, I think Lance is going to be all right in getting fewer minutes maybe, but my biggest concern is going to be his role. Because everyone who's talking about Stephenson fitting in perfectly as the bench leader of the second unit, in my opinion, hasn't watched the Pacers enough. Because Lance Stephenson, like you said, I'm totally on board with you here, that he thrived when he was the fifth best player on the floor, but when he could push the break and occasionally go into born-ready mode and just start taking guys off the dribble and pushing the ball, running like Forrest Gump up and down. If you put him in a situation where he's asked to facilitate and create and score and do all this stuff as one of the better players, as the focal point of the bench, I think that creates a different problem than the bench had last year. I much prefer the idea of Granger coming off the bench, Lance preventing him from winning back that starting spot, and strengthening the bench core that way with Granger coming off, with C.J. Watson playing alongside him, and figuring out the rotation from there.
Yeah, I think from a fit perspective, I might agree with you. I think I actually agree with you in terms of just, you know, how do the pieces fit together. But also, I think that if Danny is healthy and playing well, then the talent level is, you go with the talent level that says Danny starts, and you go from there. But I could go either way. I think that Danny's skill set might be more suited. He might have a better skill set to allow him to succeed more off the bench. But one of the things to keep in mind is that this bench has changed. And last year, Vogel talked about his vision of Lance being with the second unit and, you know, having the ball and having guys like DJ Augustine and Gerald Green as shooters. And Green never worked out, and Augustine actually got okay from a shooting perspective, but he didn't work out as an overall player. But if you think about it this year, it could be an interesting dynamic with Lance off the bench. If you can play him, let's say that you play him with a second five of Scola and either Mahimi or Copeland and Watson. I forget where else, but basically you can run a lot of, the nice part is that you can run a lot of pick and roll with him and Scola and have Watson, who's a 40% shooter, and then possibly Granger, who's a very good 3-point shooter spotting up, and he could really fit in well there. I think that's one of the areas that Scola coming could have a big positive impact, is that it puts Lance in a situation that is not quite as comfortable as that really good starting unit last year, but he could be out on the floor with a nice collection of players and a couple of knockdown shooters. I think it'd be interesting to watch him with Watson and Copeland out there on the floor.
That does intrigue me. I'm glad you keep bringing up Chris Copeland, because that goes right to the next area that I want to look at for this team. I keep looking at possible rotations, and no matter how this thing goes, I'm having trouble seeing where Chris Copeland fits in, especially the way the Pacers constructed things when they brought him in. The Luis Scola signing was something that got me excited, and a lot of Pacer fans felt the same way. But I thought it left Copeland out in the cold a little bit. Do you agree?
I think that's true. I think that's true. Copeland was, I believe, their plan B, that he was the guy that they liked the shooting, and they wanted to get him. And I think that if they couldn't make a play for like a guy like Scola, that I think they were going to go into the year and use him as that backup four position in a similar role that they used Tyler, which would be, you know, 15 to 18 minutes a night backing up David West, bringing different things. I will be interested to see what happens, because I think there's going to be a little bit of a tug of war between Mahimi and Copeland for that last role. And this is assuming that Granger is healthy and playing. Vogel seemed really interested. One of the things he brought up at the media availability was the idea of playing Scola as a five in a spread lineup with Copeland at the four and Watson and Granger out there. He really liked the idea of putting Scola in with the opportunity to make those decisions out of the high pick and roll and go into the basket. So I think that one of the things that we talked about, the identity, is, and last year the Pacers were very much We're a big physical defensive team. And while Tyler was not a rim protector, he was a very physical player, and he allowed the Pacers to remain physical for the entire 48 minutes for all of his other shortcomings. And that's not going to – that may not be there this year. We could see a lot more of West and a lot more of the horns with West and Scola on the floor. We could see a lot more of Scola or West playing with a stretch four like Copeland. Or we could see the traditional lineup with Scola at the four and Mahimi playing the backup with the bench unit. So I think it's unclear exactly where Copeland's going to fit at the moment, but I think he's going to get time simply because I think Vogel's going to want to play. He's always going to have the urge to play deeper, if you know what I mean. I think he's going to want to play 10 guys, and I think Copeland's going to be one of those 10 guys.
That's always been something that Frank Vogel has stuck to, sometimes to the chagrin of Pacer fans, when he was sticking Lou Amundsen out there and Tyler Hansbrough out there on the floor together a couple years ago against the Heat. That was disastrous. But the way that the roster's constructed now, that's not so bad. And I'm looking at it, and this is going to sound a little crazy. Feel free to try and slap me through the computer if I sound like I'm raving a little bit here. But when I'm looking at this roster as it's constructed, and the way I watched Jan Mahimi play last year, I look at a guy who improved a lot defensively as a rim protector as the year wore on. And at the end of the year in that Heat series, in the postseason, when Roy was off the floor, offensively there was a big drop-off. But defensively, Jan was just about as good at going up. And for all the credit that Roy Hibbert got, I think Jan Mahimi slid under the radar a little bit. I think he's going to be really valuable this year.
Yeah, I like Mahimi. I thought that was a good move. I thought that was intentionally done. I think that Jan, obviously, if Jan could catch,
if only.
But I really would be interested to watch watch Mahimi play in a bench unit that is more accomplished offensively. Because I think a big part of his problems last year was he tried to do too much offensively. And then I thought as the season went along a little bit, his confidence went away. I think he'd be really interesting as a guy playing out there with a Scola and a Granger where, you know, he can just do what he's supposed to do. It really isn't. I mean, thinking about this roster, if Granger is healthy, then this roster may be 11. I mean, we may have 11. We could arguably have 11 guys that should be in the rotation.
Now, who's your 11th guy? Are we talking about Solomon Hill, the rookie from Arizona? Are we talking about Orlando Johnson? I mean,
well, let me think through the things. What I'm thinking is, you got your two. You got Hill and Watson, and then you've got, I guess Lance and Danny, maybe I'm thinking 10. Solomon Hill's an interesting player. He's definitely what I refer to as a program pick, meaning that he fits the identity. He's somebody that I think that they're looking at. I think they're going to lose Danny after this year, and I think that they're looking at Solomon Hill as the backup to Paul George at the three. And I think he's going to be good there. I don't know how much he'll play, but I think I had it in my head that with Watson, Scola, Stevenson, Granger, I guess Granger would come off the bench. You're right. So 10 guys for sure. And then it's going to be so tight because theoretically guys like Granger and George and Scola and West are all guys that could be getting 30 minutes a night. So
it's a scary deep team. There's a ton of depth. This is something, again, where Pacer fans had previously just slammed Vogel. The only thing that Vogel's drawn heat for, really, besides taking Roy Hibbert off the floor in game one, is the fact that he's stuck with his rotation almost to a fault sometimes in the postseason because you can't play your starters for 48 minutes a night, and the Pacers' bench has been abominable. I don't think anymore it's a question of it being abominable. I think it's one of the best units in the East, definitely. The New Jersey Nets are up there. I think it has the potential, once everything gels, and if Vogel can find the right buttons to push, to rival just about anything that any other team can throw out there. Teams just don't get depth like this.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. Again, a lot of that's predicated on Scola fitting and Danny being healthy. Because keep in mind, if Danny had been healthy last year, then it might have been a different story with the bench. Just that one extra player could have been a difference, because if you look at I put up some charts on Twitter a few weeks ago, where what I did was I looked at the offensive and defensive efficiencies of the Pacer lineups with five starters, four starters, three starters, two, and so on. And what happened was, if you look at the defense and you lined them up, you lined up the defensive efficiency of the defense against the rest of the league, essentially all six iterations, being going from five starters to no starters on the floor, all six iterations were literally in the top seven, would have been in the top two in the league. Only Memphis's defense was as good as any rotation that the Pacers had.
Wow.
So the defense was fine, and they were an excellent offensive group. They were an excellent rebounding group too. They were just horrible offensively. They had four of the worst offensive ratings in the league. I mean, they were below 90 points per 100 possessions, which is just disastrous. And so that was what killed them. And I think that it's good that they brought the scorers in, and that's going to make brought the shooters in, and that's going to make a big difference. But really, if you look at it, well, I guess, between Scola and Granger, now they have two honest to God scorers who will be playing with the bench without having to play Paul George or George Hill or David West, 35, 38, 40 minutes a night.
There's a lot. It's a lot of stuff to think about. I don't want to spend too much more time belaboring the point. I know we're getting to the end, really the end of time. We're just about to the 40-minute mark. I want to look around the league a little bit, around the Eastern Conference particularly. We've been talking a lot about the Pacers in an individual bubble. How do they stack up against teams like the Nets, who have gotten better, against the Bulls, who have gotten Derrick Rose back?
I think the question is, if the Bulls got Derrick Rose, if the Bulls got the MVP-level Derrick Rose back, then I think they could be better than the Pacers. Much less than that, the Pacers, I believe, will be better than them. New Jersey or Brooklyn actually scares me. Brooklyn, I look at that team, and it's the reason that Brooklyn scares me is Garnett and Kirilenko. They have big, long defensive players that are going to give the Pacers problems. And I really think that if we assume that Derrick Rose is going to be healthy and close to his level, and that's a big assumption given that he hasn't played for more than a year, but close to that level, then I think you put those three teams in a box, and then Miami is, you have to assume that Miami is a little bit better than those teams. If Dwayne Wade could play at Dwayne Wade level, then Miami is definitely better than those teams. But if Wade falters, or if Wade wears down and is what he was in the playoffs, then I think any of those three teams can beat Miami in the playoffs next year.
I'm thrilled that you left the Knicks out of this discussion entirely. Thrilled, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Knicks are a puncher, but I think the Knicks are the type of team that are going to have a real hard time winning a seven-game series against a team like the Pacers or Miami, or if Brooklyn and Chicago are who I think they're going to be, simply because they aren't deep enough. They don't play enough defense, and they're a dangerous team, but I just don't. I think they've kind of backed up some.
So basically, the Knicks have penciled themselves into a 5 seed, with the rest of the East being extraordinarily deep and top heavy. That's good to know. We'll move from that. I want to ask really quick one question, just more about standings, because if you look at how the East has shaken out the past 3 years of LeBron playing for the Miami Heat, it's been a necessity for the Eastern Conference team near the top that wants to face them in the conference finals to finish with that 2 or 3 seed. Because if you finish with the 4, like the Pacers did a couple years ago, you're going to draw them in the semis, and then you got to knock out the champ before you even get to the Eastern Conference finals. I think that's a tall order for any team to do. How do you see that race for the 2 or 3 seed going this year? Well, we just talked about it, but how ready are the Nets and the Bulls to adjust to each other as opposed to the Pacers?
I think all of them have a lot of change to happen. The thing about the Nets, I think the Nets have big pluses in Pierce and Kirilenko and Garnett, but they have a big question mark with Jason Kidd. It will be interesting to see how well he does as a coach this year. I mean, clearly a very bright player and an outstanding player, but it's a big task for a brand new coach. So that's the question there. Thibodeau is something else in Chicago, so if he's got a healthy Rose, then he's pretty scary. I think you definitely want to stay out of that second round bracket with Miami, but I'm not sure where that second round bracket's going to be, because I don't know if Miami might not kind of give up the number one seed this year. If I were Miami, I might consider taking a little weight off of Wade during the regular season, and not worrying about winning 60, 65 games. I would be more focused on being 100% healthy heading into the playoffs. So that's kind of the thing, is that normally you'd say, I want to be the 2 or the 3 seed because Miami's going to be the number one. But I could see any of the 3 teams, Indiana, Chicago, or Brooklyn, ending up with the number one seed because Miami took the foot off the gas a little bit in the regular season.
That would be another wrinkle. It's another thing to consider, especially as we are now in the dog days of the NBA offseason, still finding time to talk NBA basketball, and particularly Indiana Pacer basketball. Tim Donahue, I want to thank you for joining us. We're about out of time. Before I let you go, anything to plug, promote, or talk about?
Not really, not at the moment. Hoping to get back to do some more stuff, looking at some lineups and things like that for the Pacers. But I think they're going to be fun to watch this year again, and hopefully we're one more series along. We're talking about one more series next June, instead of we got to the conference finals. We got to watch the Pacers get to the conference finals. And hopefully we get to watch the Pacers get to the finals this year.
No question. And if you won't say it, I will. You can follow Tim on Twitter at Tim Donahue, 8P9S. That's all one word. Donahue, DonaHue. You'll find it. You'll figure it out. He's a great follow, especially when the NBA season rolls around. Tim, thanks for joining us. It's been awesome.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Look forward to having you on next time. Folks, that's all we got for IC Squared. I'm Jimmy Cavanaugh. Look forward to having you back next time. Good night, travel well, and thanks for listening.